Hi, Paul Sloan here. Welcome to my podcast series, where I talk to some people I know about the influences, turning points, and lessons from their lives. So my guest today is an old friend, Philip Anderson. Philip, can you tell us a little bit about yourself? Where were you born?
Yes, well, that's in itself a bit of a story. The simple answer is I was born in Biddeford in Devon. The more interesting answer is that I was the first person to be born in England for generations on either of my mother and father's side. So my mother was born in France, and her mother was French. Her father was half Italian and half English. My father was born in China, and his father and his grandfather were born in Japan. And they came from Northern Ireland. When people say, oh, you sound very British, and I say, well, clearly I do. I spent a lot of my life living, working, or travelling outside of England.
Did you have a happy childhood?
Well, that fell into two pieces, really. The main memory from childhood, my father was in the army. He joined the army when the Second World War broke out. Left school, he was going to be a lawyer. He had an offer from Cambridge, which he didn't take up, and he stayed in the army after the war. He decided it was his duty to do it. As a result, we went to several countries. So the whole family was in Germany, where my two younger sisters were born. My brother was born in Singapore, where my parents met and got married. And then after that, my poor brother was put into boarding school at a horrendously young age, and he's older than me. Then me and my two sisters went with my parents to what was then Malaya, and we went on a ship to get out there. Long, long sail, 6 to 8 weeks. Amazing experience. And the time we had out there was magical. It was unlike anything I'd ever experienced before, and I had absolutely no desire to experience anything different. I had a lot of freedom. I loved the climate. And we went and had all sorts of adventures as a family. Yeah, it was really amazing. I had some lovely friendships. So that, I would say, was a very happy part of my life. But, you know, it came to an end. And after, I think it was 3 and a bit years, on a ship back, father says, you know, we've got to go back. I've got a job back in England. And when we got back, that was the biggest shock in my life, because I was put into the same boarding school my father had been in. My brother was in the senior school, and I was put into the primary school. Well, it was the middle of a summer term. So you think how relationships are made when you're at school. They're made over the course of a year or several years, but to come in right at the end of a school year, you were very disadvantaged. And I really struggled at school. I didn't know at the time. I never heard the word at the time, but I'm dyslexic. So I have a difficulty in just learning stuff by rote. And it was all by rote. And I knew it wasn't stupid, but I was beaten because I couldn't spell right, or I was beaten because I couldn't complete a sentence or answer something. You know, those things were really quite a shock to me. And so that part of my life was a very quick growing up experience. I was very naive. I was probably very young for my age. And I don't know why, but I was put in a year group where about 90% of them were older than me, much older than me. I don't know why that was the case. So it sort of made it a bit more difficult. My redemption was that I'm athletic. My father was athletic. And I could run fast, jump high, throw fast. I'd already played cricket on the beach with my dad. And I got into all the sports teams. We had athletics, you know, sports day. I could swim faster than anyone because I I lived in a swimming pool for 3 years. I could throw a ball further because my father taught me how to do it, you know, and all those things. So suddenly I had a bit of street cred and it got a bit easier. So, you know, it was a bumpy ride really. And the senior school, very isolating. I was desperate to get away. And we were up in Lancashire, very cut off from civilization. You know, it was a remote place. And I found that hard, but I did find ways of escaping to do anything. You know, I joined every society, hiking, debating, anything that got me out of the school. And I also met my wife-to-be, where, for goodness knows why, the school decided to have a school dance with the local, well, nearest possible convent school in Preston. And, well, there's a story in that. So that's really the story of early education.
What did you do after school?
Well, after school, I didn't get the world's best A-levels. And I had offers at two or three universities to do architecture. I was very good at art. I was interested in it. And I had a very close friend who was doing it, and his father was quite a well-known architect. I thought, actually, it sounds really, really interesting. It was the best thing that happened to me that I didn't. You know, there's no internet in those days. I had another friend who was 3 years older than me, who was doing a business degree, which was a sandwich course. I don't think they call them that these days, but a four-year business degree where you have a year in industry. Oh yeah, I went to the local library and I saw where the various places were. Philippa had already chosen to do her degree in Manchester, which was a business degree. And my first port of call was Leicester. You know, I'd written to them and persuaded them that really they should give me a chance. And they did. And it was probably one of the happiest 4 years of my life. I just learned so much. We're a very small band. The course only had 25, I think, on it. It was very intensive. We covered a great range of subjects and we all supported each other. If anyone was stuck, you know, there was someone who wasn't in that area and, you know, you got help or you helped them. We made some very lovely friendships actually out of that.
Can you take us through a few highlights of your business career?
Yeah, I think there's fate in things, isn't there, Paul? Highlights work-wise, I've never sat in my bum thinking, what am I going to do? You know, I've always wanted to get on and to be independent. So at a very young age, I did a paper round or I worked in a factory making spectacle frames. Health and safety didn't exist in those days. I could rail you with stories about, you know, what I did without any protective equipment. And then I got the degree, had some choices, but then I saw a little ad in the Daily Telegraph from a company called Bupa. Who were recruiting their first graduate trainees, two of them. They'd never done it before. Anyway, long story short, I got the job and I really never looked back. It wasn't that I was ruthlessly ambitious at all. I've learned, I went off to a training branch for nearly 6 months, loved it, made some wonderful friends, had lots of fun, and then brought back into a head office role, which gave me contact across the whole organization. But I had a mentor, but I didn't know that word existed at the time. My boss's boss's boss, someone called Jerry Williams, he ran the Bupa cricket team, passionate about cricket. And so I got involved in that. I was a reasonable cricketer, I guess. And I ended up taking it on from him. So I then was captaining this team. We used to play every Wednesday evening through the summer months and play what is now called 2020. But he encouraged me. And I can remember an assistant manager's job came up in one of the branches, which is really where I wanted to get to a branch. And I remember saying to him, look, I've seen this as being advertised. Do you think it'd be a bit crazy me going for it? I'm probably much younger than anyone. So I'm gonna say, go for it. Yeah, you've got to go for it. So I did and I got it. And from there, I learned the lesson. If you think you'd like to try something, throw your hat in the ring and have a go. And make sure you're well prepared for it and enthusiastic about it. And that's really what happened. And very, very quickly, I progressed through the company. And then in my mid-30s, I ended up going off to Singapore as the managing director of a business that was a joint venture between Bupa and a very major Malaysian company. Very soon after that, the group chief executive of the group of companies in that joint venture moved on. It was like doing a real live MBA 100% of the time. It affirmed in my mind that the thing I really enjoyed most about working was working with individuals, bringing people on. And I did a lot of work outside of.
But then you left Bupa and set up your own company, did you?
I set myself that I wasn't going to get any work unless it had a main board sponsor, preferably the chief executive. I would go and read the papers and go to a library, go and talk to friends, go and network, try and find out where there was an opening. And what I was looking for was to facilitate senior executive meetings and to mentor those who were on that team. That's really what I set out to do. I knew I was good on my feet. I've done lots of it at work. I was good at pulling things together. And I have a lot of fun doing it. Very quickly, I built up a portfolio. And then I got introduced to someone who was leaving a company which I was doing some work for. And he wanted to set up a business. And cut long story short, we ended up having two businesses, a consulting company and a software company. And we used the software, which is building an accessible, anyone in the business could see it and use it, front end to understanding all the processes in the business. And it was linked to the systems behind it. It was really very good software. And we'd use that in our consulting work. But the thing I was really interested in was working with the sponsor, and I ended up mentoring many, many interesting people. And eventually I bowed out of that. My father was very seriously ill, and I had some health problems. My eyes, I was having a really difficult time with my eyes. I had a series of operations. So I really decided I've just got to pull back. And then I've really been working for myself since 2005, I suppose. I chaired a research business, and I've been involved in lots of initiatives. But mostly I mentor, facilitate workshops. And since the lockdown, it's been online mentoring.
And you also had a wonderful family, didn't you?
I did, yes. I still do. Yes, I'm very, very lucky.
Please tell us a little about your family.
I have four daughters. So if you ask me, what was the smartest thing you ever did was to marry Philippa. You know, she was 16, 17 when I met her, and I was a similar age. The day I met her, we were at the school dance, and she said to me, "Where are you going to go for Christmas?" Because I told her I lived overseas. I said, "Well, I'm going off to Singapore." And I said, "Oh, amazing. I'd love to go there." And I said, "Well, it'll happen. Don't worry. One day I'll marry you and we'll go out there." And that's exactly what we did. What I'm proudest of are the girls, the four girls. Proud in the sense of I'm just so delighted to have them in our lives. Everything they achieve has got nothing to do with me. I've never seen it like that. But they are delightful. They're very, very different. You can have four different girls, and they all have different talents, personalities.
So, Philip, your story so far has been one of happiness and success. But then a great setback befell you, didn't it? Can you tell us about that, please?
Yes. So, how long ago? Probably about 7 or 8 years ago. Two things, right? One was I'd suddenly collapsed in a heap. And I put it down to rugby injuries. I did play rugby at quite a high standard, and I did get quite beaten up, breaking limbs and stitched up here and there and so on. And I thought, well, I've had a cartilage out of one knee. I've had a bit of bone removed out of an ankle. So I knew that structurally there were some problems there. So I just put it down to that. But then I found that when I was in the gym, I always have energy to burn off. I just couldn't do things in the way I could before. And also, I started noticing my muscles didn't seem to be the same. Not that I was, ancient or anything. So that's really how it started. And also, I became very nervous about rushing. So throughout our time together, Philippa was always, her little legs were pegging along beside me, which was a foot smaller, and I'd be still striding on. We had a bit of a role reversal where she was striding off ahead of me, particularly on stairs. It was just intuitive. I was actually quite scared I was going to fall. Anyway, we went out. One of our daughters was living in Dubai with her husband, so it was a good excuse to have a winter break in the sun. And we used to go to her and then go off back to Southeast Asia. And we had this holiday on a remote island off Malaysian coast, and I was waiting for my moment to say to Philippa that I think there's something not quite right here. I didn't really need to tell her because she was worried, and also I made a spectacular entrance into reception when I fell down the stairs. We agreed when we get back, we've got to get to the bottom of this, and that's really where the journey started, 2014. And I guess, Paul, I'm like everyone. When you have a condition, there is something you really want to know. Okay, what is it? Tell me what's going on here. And then you want to know how it can be fixed. And then you want to know how quickly that's going to happen. I think that's probably the way it is for most people. I was referred to a specialist locally, a rheumatologist, lovely man, had a whole load of tests, which in itself were the beginning of, I cannot tell you how many tests I've had, some of which have been very, very unpleasant. He put his arm around Philippa when we went back for a follow-up after various tests to say, "Philippa, look, I'm really sorry, but I think your husband's got motor neuron disease." And thing was absolutely for sure, it doesn't happen to people like us. No, you got this wrong. And he then referred me up to London to the National Hospital for Neurology in Queen Square. It's just around the corner from Great Ormond Street, the famous children's hospital. And I pretty much lived there on and off every year since, except last year with COVID. And I've been through everything I could go through.
So, what is the condition that you suffer from?
Well, that's therein lies the tale. If you're going to catch a condition where you really, it's important to you that you really know what it is, don't have a neurological condition. Don't have a condition that goes into neuro under the banner of the neurology specialty, because it's the area where the least is known, is the area which is the most interesting for medical practitioners because there's so much to learn. And it's an area where between a quarter and a third of everyone never gets a diagnosis. So I have had 10 or 11 possible diagnoses along the way. That's been a really difficult journey. At one stage, they thought I had amyloidosis, which was at the same time, about 3 months after the Northern Irish politician, Martin McGuinness, had died of it, 6 months after being diagnosed. So that was a really moment. And then, yes, I did have some symptoms, but no, I didn't have amyloidosis. And that's really been the story. Yes, you do have symptoms of this. You could have had fascioscapular humeral dystrophy because you've got winging shoulder blades and a lot of wastage in your muscles, which is very similar to someone who has FSHD. You could have this, you could have that. But ultimately, it comes down to how best to deal with it. All through this time, I said, look, I'm willing to try sensible treatments. And I have had many different drug infusions, high-dose steroids, which nearly killed me, which were guaranteed to give me strength and extra energy. Nothing from it. I had three long periods of immunotherapy extracted from the blood of 10,000 healthy people, mystifyingly got no benefit from it. So there was a seminal moment about 3 years ago when my neurologist, my current and then neurologist, who's been very, very good, very determined, had a pretty brutal conversation with me. It felt brutal. You know, I'd had this final set of infusions, and this was a follow-up consultation. They've been monitoring my blood since then. And it was not a very long consultation, Philippa and I, in Queen's Square, where the National Hospital is. And I'll never forget it. She said to me, Philip, this is the end of the line. Your body can't take any more. You need to focus on keeping as well as you can and get the support you're going to need. And I've written about this in an article I call Holding On to Hope. But it's almost like hope had suddenly flown away out of me. That's the only way I can describe it. It was completely gutting. It wasn't a surprise. And the surprise was that was the message. And it sucked everything out of me. You know, all my energy, my optimism. I felt that I'd been on a fool's journey, you know, having put myself through all this. And there's a very famous poem, actually, by Emily Dickinson called Hope is a Thing with Feathers. And I wrote a response to that, to deny it. The first verse was, hope has taken flight, perch forlorn, tune without the words I cannot hear at all. And it ends with, help me here to understand, in the strangest sea, it is never in enmity, that little bird taunting me. So that's me reaching out to try and find a way of finding hope. And that was a very important moment. You asked about my faith. There was a darkness in there and a true test of my faith. And one thing that comes with a condition where you're 100% now reliable on full-time care, I have a full-time carer, is you have a lot of time for reflection, because you know, I can't do anything until she comes in to get me out of bed and, you know, get me in my chair and so on. So my brain's in overdrive and I think a lot about faith, but I also listen to programs and music. I'm very, very keen on music, have been all my life, which give me a lot of sustenance. And I see it for what it is. And that last article about cherishing the cracks, let the light in, because that's the way, you know, your path is illuminated. And I truly feel that that is the case for me.
What use of your muscles do you have now, Philip?
Well, you can hear my voice. I have good days and bad days. I'm relieved it's good today. But really all my muscles, you know, in my mouth and jaw, my swallowing, you can work all the way down my body, my arms, my legs, are affected. And
you are permanently in a wheelchair?
Yes, I can't use my legs. I have a power wheelchair. I get myself around. But my arms, I have to balance my elbow and try and angle my hand, which hangs down. You know, I can't put it straight and I can't close my hand. But I can grip my thumb against my finger. So I still mostly manage to feed myself. I make a lot of mess in the process. I take a lot of fluid. All my fluid is by a straw, including my lunch, which is a soup every day. That's really what it is. That's how it is.
So you said that when your neurologist told you the news, it took you to a very low place. But since then, you found writing. You use software, which transforms your voice into the written word. And I've read some of your writings, and they're very, very moving.
Well, you're very sweet. I had decided I was going to write a memoir about the journey, and I have written quite a lot. But I put it aside. You know, there's too much to contend with. And I thought, well, what I can do is crystallize my thinking through this, particularly this year of COVID. And I've been in isolation throughout that period, plus before the official lockdown, completely counter my whole nature. You know, I'm very social and I love getting out there. I love the arts. I love live music and so on. So a lot of time to think, a lot of time to collate. And yes, I've been writing articles.
And the articles you write appear on independentliving.co.uk, and I believe they have inspired other people. Is that right?
The people have been very generous in what they've said to me, you know, very encouraging. But also I can see what it's meant for some people. And I never really thought of it like that. The most recent comment from someone who clearly has just got something. He didn't reveal whether it was an accident or an illness, which had caused him to have disability, but he'd never used the word or written it before. And it was such a heartfelt comment under the article. And he'd taken strength from it, which really makes it all worthwhile, really, for me. And others have said they're using it in their cancer support group and so on, these articles, to draw something out of them. So I'm very happy about that, Paul. But I guess I've developed a style. I have a bit of fun with them. There's humour in them. I bring in all sorts of different elements. And there's always music in there. Yeah, and I've started writing poems and started dropping them in. And I won a prize in a poetry competition.
Well done. So what do you still want to achieve in life? And how would you like to be remembered?
Well, in terms of achievement, I want to live, Paul. I want to live as fully as I possibly can. What I want to achieve, live as fully as I possibly can. I make the most of my life. I've got no desire to die. I want to have time with my family and my friends. I want to be able to, well, be hugged. I find it quite hard to hug others. I miss that physical contact. I'm tactile. I want to go and hear live music again and go to exhibitions and live theatre and so on. These things are really important to me, and have time with my friends. I'm very blessed. I've got some very good friends. So that's really what I look forward to. In terms of how I'd like to be remembered, well, I've got no, you know, illusions that people are going to remember me in any particular heroic way. But if they do remember me, I guess that I'd like to think people would say he listened. You know, I've always been willing to listen to people and to deeply listen and to help people think through things. So I've had to swallow my own therapy in that respect. They cared. I do care. I care about lots of things, you know, the environment, nature. I care that people with disability are so cut off in so many different ways. And I'm involved in all sorts of advisory groups now. And my current, the article I'm writing at the moment touches on this. But more than anything else, he was a hell of a lot of fun to be around.
That's good. And if there was one moral or lesson from your life, Philip, what would you want it to be?
Well, probably make the most of every day. You know, there's no guarantee that any of us have got tomorrow. And of course, when you're in this situation, you know that's the case. And there's always something that can bring you joy. And you know, talking about how you want to be remembered, you won't be remembered by what you achieved. You'll be remembered what you're like as a human being. And actually, that's who we are. You know, we are human. Human beings are human doings. And I guess that's probably right up there at the top of my messages. And be very thankful for all the love in your life, and give love wherever you can, you know, in a way that's unconditional.
Philip Anderson, thank you very much.
It's a pleasure, Paul. Thank you.